Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
People call upon their self-control when they're trying to stick to a diet, stay on the wagon, or kick the habit. This is Colleen Shaddix for the Yale Office of Public Affairs, talking with Dr. Roy Baumeister, a psychologist who studied self-control extensively. His work looks at the factors that diminish our self-control and measures that might actually strengthen it. You call self-control a limited resource. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, yes, there's only so much of it. And when you've used it up, then you can't do as well until it replenishes. We've been calling it the strength, the idea of strength. Willpower is like a muscle. Muscle strength is a limited resource too. Mm-hmm. Your muscle gets tired. And so after you've exercised the muscle pretty hard, then it won't perform at peak capacity until it's had a chance to rest and recover. And it's the same way with self-control. In many laboratory studies, we have people do a series of self-control tasks, and whatever order you put them in, they just tend to get worse at the later ones mm-hmm. because they've used up some of this limited resource on the earlier ones.
So we know, like, typically people gain 10 pounds when they quit smoking. Is that sort of a manifestation of what you're talking about?
Well, I know there are multiple theories as to why this happens, but this certainly is one of them. Yes, that while you're working on quitting smoking, you're devoting your self-control capabilities into that, into resisting temptation, staying with the smoking program. Because there's a limited resource, mm-hmm. that means there's not as much left over for restraining your eating, for influencing other things. Now, as I said, there may be other things going on there as well. People argue that smoking just naturally suppresses your appetite, and there might be some contribution to that too. But yes, in general, putting all your efforts into one thing takes away from other possible uses. I have colleagues in Australia who have shown that students, when it comes to exam time, most of their other self-control programs go downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same sort of thing. Many students fall behind as the semester wears on. Exams are coming up. You better get yourself ready. So you channel most of your self-control into getting your assignments done, getting your studying done, catching up, keeping up, and preparing yourself there. Other things that you'd use normally self-control for, like eating right, keeping your hair washed, changing mm-hmm. your socks, being nice to other people instead of crabby, not smoking, and so on. There's not enough willpower for those. And so, sure enough, the students at exam time will become crabbier, will go back to smoking more, will eat erratically, and so forth.
Now, because addiction is a lifetime thing, this seems like it could have some pretty grim implications. If you've been in recovery for years, have you effectively sort of used up the resource that's helping you stay clean and sober?
No, it doesn't work like that. This is a short-term effect, the limited resource. If anything, we also have evidence that, like a muscle, as you continue to exercise it, mm-hmm. it may get stronger. When you need it most for bringing about a change in your behavior. So when you're first, say, quitting smoking, you'll need a lot of willpower to do that down the road. Once you've been off cigarettes for 6 months and so on, then you're not fighting as hard, perhaps day by day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't need as much self-control to stay clean. The depletion of this will occur mainly on a day-to-day basis in the early part when you're struggling to bring mm-hmm. about the change in your behavior. Sustaining it doesn't take as much, and as I said, it may even be that you get stronger by virtue of exercising yourself, by making yourself quit. That may improve your willpower. I know some of the studies on quitting smoking show that many people quit smoking over and over, and they get mm-hmm. better at it each time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various explanations for that, too, but one of them is that you are improving the self-control muscle. You are strengthening yourself. Each time you do it, you get yourself a little bit stronger.
So it's a limited resource, but it's a renewable resource,
too. It's very much a renewable resource. One thing that seems to renew it is eating. Another seems to be sleeping. That we found when we first reviewed the scientific literature on self-control, there were just day patterns that hardly anyone leaps out of bed in the morning and goes on an eating binge or a smoking binge mm-hmm. or a drug binge or alcohol or sex or whatever. You seem to, if you wake up after a good night's sleep, with pretty good self-control. And then as the day wears on, the likelihood of breakdowns increase. So most diets are broken in the evening, not in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Impulsive crimes are mostly committed after midnight, mm-hmm. not first thing in the morning, and on as well. So yes, it renews, and it seems to wear down during the day.
Can you talk a little bit about the connection between stress and self-control?
Well, that is something we are just embarking on starting to study and try to learn about. It seems to me, and basically, the stress is a set of external demands that are made on your body and your mind. And so, yes, if you have limited resources and it's the same resource used for many different things, then stress will make more demands on that, and mm-hmm. so you will have less for that. And so why do people not treat their husband and wife as nicely when they're under stress at the office? Well, again, a limited amount of self-control. They're channeling it into coping with the stress at the office, and there's less left over when they get home in the evening to make themselves remember to be nice and sweet. So that is one aspect. But there's a great deal more that we have still to learn about that.
And you mentioned that sleep helps with self-control, but you've actually developed some exercises that help. Can you describe one for us?
Well, we are trying to find ways to strengthen it. If indeed self-control works like a muscle, then like a muscle, it gets tired when you exercise it, but when it recovers from the mm-hmm. exercise, it may recover to be a little bit stronger. So what we have done in a number of studies now is give people arbitrary rules to follow to try to change their behavior. The first study we did, and it sounds silly, the thing that worked best was telling people to work on their posture. And so for 2 weeks, we said, whenever you think of it, sit up straight, stand up straight. Just change your posture. That's a very mm-hmm. simple, basic self-control exercise. And then it turned out, people came back to the laboratory after 2 weeks on laboratory tests that had nothing to do with posture. They still perform better. Hmm. That somehow those little exercises seem to strengthen the muscle. And this has made me rethink the value of arbitrary rules and so on. I mean, I'm from the generation where when we were in school, we rebelled against those, and we said we don't need dress codes, and we shouldn't have to stand up straight, right. And all those things were just silly, jumping through hoops for no reason. And so we rebelled against them. And now my research is telling me that having to jump through hoops does have a reason in terms of building character, and it improves your ability to do other things, even if the hoop itself was fairly meaningless. So other exercises people can do, you can try to improve your speech. I mean, the essence of self-control is to override one response, a habit or an inclination or an impulse, and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
So anything like that as an exercise that you do regularly could in principle work to strengthen the muscle. Another thing we rebelled against was that we weren't supposed to swear when I was little. And now I hear people curse and swear all the time. That's become very, very fashionable. And I used to wonder, why does society have words that no one's allowed to say? But again, an arbitrary rule like that, to know the word and to think of saying that when you're frustrated and to resist, that exerts self-control, and that strengthens perhaps your capacity to resist other temptations and to follow other rules and to do other things that are of more pragmatic utility than not pronouncing a certain syllable.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the work you're doing with college students?
We are conducting studies to test the basic processes of how self-control breaks down, of how the resource gets depleted, what possible things people can do to cope when they're in a state when their willpower is depleted, what other things use the same resource. Some of our recent work has shown that making decisions seems to draw on the same resource. And so after you make a lot of decisions, mm-hmm. your self-control is going to be impaired. And people don't intuitively understand that, and they don't expect that. We're certainly always surprised and indignant when decision makers in our society, executives and politicians and so on, then succumb to temptations and become alcoholic or engage in sexual things, misconduct or whatever. And I don't want to make excuses for such misbehavior, but we can perhaps understand that after you've expended a lot of the resource in making decisions, if that takes away from your capacity for self-control, some of these problems can be predicted and understood, and if we can anticipate them, then perhaps people can avoid them better. So in the laboratory, I mean, we don't have executives and world leaders, obviously, but we find there, even with college students, having them make a series of decisions and then, say, testing their ability to break a habit or to hold their hand in ice water or any kind of the standard laboratory measures of self-control, if they do worse because of that, well, that's an indication, indeed, that we are dealing with a common resource here.
And it, in some ways, perhaps studying college students is more useful than studying world leaders because it is a time when we know that people do fall prey to dangerous behaviors, potentially addictive behaviors.
The college years are a vulnerable time. I think one reason we study them is that there are more of them and they're more
they're
willing
handy
to be in their studies
yeah.
than world leaders who are probably not going to stop by our laboratory. But most of the same principles apply. I mean, they may apply a little bit stronger or weaker. Periodically in my field, which often most researchers work at universities, and then we wonder, well, are our results on students generalizable to others? But the same principles generally tend to apply. There are very few things in which college students are so different from everyone else that what you learn as a basic principle doesn't apply.
A lot of the work that we're talking about is happening as part of Yale's Stress, Self-Control, and Addiction Consortium, which is interdisciplinary. You're a social psychologist. How is working with people from the biological sciences shaping what you do?
Well, it's a very exciting opportunity for me to extend my thinking and to learn more about related fields. You see, the self's ability to control itself, I mean, to us, this is a psychological phenomenon, but it rests on biological processes that were shaped by evolution. Things happen in the brain and in the rest of the body. We've gotten findings about that the fuel for brain processes, in the sense of the glucose in the bloodstream, tends to be depleted after acts of self-control. We're exploring now, are there genetic markers that make some people more vulnerable to these patterns than others? We know certainly people differ wildly in their basic capacities for self-control. Some of it is probably how their parents brought them up, but part of it may also be things that are genetic. And so I do think everybody can get better at self-control, but what you want to do, we might learn eventually to tailor how we treat people and how we help people based on their biological and genetic proclivities to start with. Likewise, once you brought up the idea of stress, stress too is both a psychological and a biological phenomenon, and that how the body is affected and how it reacts to it, all sorts of things may be going on with hormones released and whatnot that can interact and interfere in interesting ways with overt behavioral processes and with the thoughts and feelings that accompany them. So again, for me, this is a fascinating and exciting opportunity to extend my knowledge and my understanding of these phenomena and to share what I know with people in other fields that in the same way might not have a clue about the behavioral and the mental parts, even though they have wonderful expertise about the biological parts.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Roy Baumeister about self-control. He's a professor at Florida State University and a faculty member in Yale's Stress, Self-Control, and Addiction Consortium. For more information, visit yalestress.org.